As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. I'm Mark Chapman. Coming up a little later in the pod, Greg Evans will tell us how Aston Villa held firm to sign Philippe Coutinho. And we'll talk to Adam Leventhal about Watford's new boss, Rob Edwards, who is going to have a lot of work to do after their relegation to the Championship. First up, the focus is Leeds United, who are now outside of the Premier League drop zone. But rivals Burnley and Everton both have games in hand before they all play their last game this weekend. I'm joined by The Athletic's Phil Hay. You're sort of mystic, Phil, aren't you, really? Your tweet from November of last year, this season is going to kill everyone.
Yeah, so when I came out the ground yesterday, somebody said to me, you know how they've started talking about the possibility that one day a person will live to 1,000 years old. Well, it's not going to be any of us. I mean, the weird thing about yesterday is that we've seen that several times this season. It felt just like the Joe Gellhart game against Norwich. It was as desperate as that moment. It felt as urgent as that moment. And I think the fact that we have been here before tells you how hard it's been for Leeds to get themselves out of this, how deeply they've sunk into it, because they are still clinging to 92nd minute goals. They are still clinging to anything from anywhere to drag them out of it. And I don't know. I mean, that point yesterday, it might just save them. It might just be enough. And I think that was the feeling coming out of the ground. It's probable that they will need more, and I don't think they can rely on Burnley losing these next two games. But even so, it was a massive moment at a point where I think even the crowd who've been really supportive all season, even they had pretty much given up hope.
Is it a season defined by desperation then?
I think it is, and it's been building right from the start. Somebody tweeted a couple of weeks ago that scene from Austin Powers where they run over the security guard with the steamroller, starting from about 100 metres away. And it does feel like that. It's not that everybody saw this coming in the summer, but when you start to piece together now the things that have gone wrong and the areas in which it's failed, it's absolutely everything. It is the recruitment. It's the form of individual players. It's the tactics not working for Bielsa in the way that they had previously. It's the small squad size exacerbated by the injuries. Everything has just come together, this accumulation of pressure that's left them clinging on. And that's how it was yesterday. I mean, the pint yesterday was owed to Danny Welbeck for that missed header with a couple of minutes to go, because that was an absolute sitter. And if that goes in, it's game over. And I think the stadium becomes even more volatile than it had become. And it was getting toxic yesterday, not quite for the first time this season, but almost for the first time this season. There was chanting against the board. There were chants for Bielsa. It was just that kind of fraying patience, that loss of patience, which always comes inevitably in a season like this. But then, as has been the case for Leeds all season, that strike goal comes right at the end, and suddenly everybody can see a way out of it.
Where do you think Leeds fans are with Jesse Marsh?
There's certainly a debate there, without any question. I mean, the whole point of Marsh coming in for Bielsa at the time when he did, at the end of February, was that Leeds had lost faith in Bielsa. They thought they were going down. They didn't think by retaining him they had much chance of staying up. So it was a decision that was supposed to keep them in the Premier League. And it wasn't as if he had a huge number of games, but he had 12, and 12 seemed to everybody to be enough if his tactics clicked and his system took hold. I think at the problem at the moment is that you're not seeing a style of play develop, and if anything, Leeds are stuck between the old Bielsa system and whatever it is that Marsh wants his system to be. They haven't completed that transition at all, and we've seen multiple different formations. We've seen three at the back. It was almost five at the back against Chelsea. It was 4-2-3-1 yesterday. You've had Rodrigo in the team, out the team, Matthias Klik in the team, out the team, struggling really to fall on a specific plan that works and works consistently. And it would be very fair to say that a large portion of the crowd are pretty unconvinced by this. I think the argument that Leeds would make is that once he has a transfer window and they kind of rectify a squad that is quite clearly inadequate. I mean, the bottom line this season is that the squad has just not been good enough. Once he has that, once he has pre-season, this could and should all look different. But I think at this stage, there's certainly scepticism about whether or not this has been the right decision.
And it's interesting you mentioned transfer window, because obviously one of the big criticisms aimed at Leeds, and we've had this discussion on this pod before, is, well, they didn't do anything in the last transfer window to help. So their philosophy will change in this transfer window, will it?
I think it's going to have to. As you tend to get with clubs when they do badly, there's always an argument about investment and has there been enough money spent. I don't think you could level that at Leeds and saying that they haven't spent. They've invested about 150 million and in the last 2 years, they haven't used player sales to fund that. You know, they haven't used Phillips, they haven't used Rafinha, although, you know, conceivably both of them could go this summer depending on what happens. But they haven't, you know, they haven't used players going out to fund players coming in. The issue has been the impact of that recruitment. So few of the more expensive signings, Rodrigo being an example, just haven't paid off as they should have done. And it means that you've got the core of the Championship squad, which came up, which is aging and to some extent will need to be phased out as you go, combined with players who've come in and who just haven't done it for them. And you're right, I mean, nothing happened in January. They did bid for Brendan Aaronson at RB Salzburg, but they didn't get him. And there was this inertia where they were caught in a scenario where the club seemed to realise that they needed players. And when he spoke to Bielsa, he would say, yeah, you know, I would accept players if we could find them. But a lot of the players who were suggested to him, he wasn't keen on. He didn't think they would fit. They didn't go for any of them in the end. Players like Van de Beek, Harry Winks, because they couldn't get Aaronson, it just drew a blank. And it felt as if at that stage, you know, at the end of the window, there were a lot of public expressions of confidence in the squad. You know, we've got enough to stay up. We think we will be fine. But then 3 weeks down the line, 3-4 weeks down the line, you're sacking Bielsa and you're saying we don't think he's going to do it. And I think, as I say, I think it has been inertia. I think to an extent towards the end, you had a scenario where the tail was wagging the dog rather than the other way around. And I think when we look back, we'll say that doing nothing in January was a big mistake. And actually, if the club didn't have confidence in Bielsa at the end of February, they should have been looking at it in that transfer window and saying, if we're going to do this, if a change does need to be made, is this the time to do it?
If they stay up, the vultures will be circling, won't they? If they go down, the vultures will be picking them off, won't they?
Absolutely. Rafinha was on the pitch after the game yesterday, sat against the goalpost, and it was very much the body language of someone who looked like he was kind of looking at Elland Road for the last time.
He looks to me like Bielsa's gone, I need to go.
Well, funnily enough, it wasn't all sweetness and light between those two towards the end.
Right.
Rafinha was substituted at halftime in the defeat at Everton in February, and they spoke the following week. They had words after training. When I say they had words, they sat down and chatted it over. And then, you know, Bielsa, as he tended to do, he would always follow his own mind. So Rafinha was on the bench the following weekend against Manchester United. But he did play his best football here under Bielsa, without a doubt. And I think Rafinha's been player of the season with no question. And you know, the pool of options in that regard is not massive. But, you know, he's scored a lot of the goals. He's carried Leeds more than he should have had to do. And yesterday, watching him sat on the pitch, you did think that was the body language of a player who won't be here for much longer. And actually, we all felt that anyway. There's been a huge amount of chatter about Barcelona. He is that standard of player. You know, he will go to a Champions League club. With Calvin Phillips, it's a little bit more difficult to tell. And the club have kind of been hopeful that they might pin him down to a new contract for one more year. They know that ultimately he's going to want to play at a higher level. But you're right. I mean, if they go down, Rafinha leaves, it seems to me impossible to persuade Phillips that that's good for his prospects, given that there's a World Cup coming up later in the year. And I think there'd be question marks about other players as well. I think the best players in the squad would like you say, would attract attention. People would wonder if they could pay them out of Elland Road, because Leeds will be in a position where they need to think about offers coming in, and they'll also have players who would say to them, I don't particularly want to play in the Championship. So it is crucial in that respect. And others, you know, in terms of the longer-term planning with stadium development and everything else, they do need to be a Premier League club. But at least that point yesterday gives them half a chance.
They do have their new hero in Gelhardt, don't they?
He's a terrific player. He really is. There was a huge amount of interest in him when he came from Wigan. And, I mean, the initial fee up front was less than £1 million, and that was purely because Wigan were in administration. It was kind of fire sale time, so you were getting him at a fraction of the value that he's actually worth. And I spoke to somebody who knows him really well, who said, you know, I would have put my mortgage on him being worth 10 times as much in the space of a year. He's just got that. A lot of people compare him to Rooney. He's a Merseyside lad. He's got that kind of same physique as Rooney, quite stocky, quite well built. And he's just got that kind of playground edge to him, you know, that street football edge to him, where he does ridiculously good things in circumstances where you kind of don't think a player of that age or that inexperience should be able to do it. And it was just magical, that little bit. It was a kind of strange goal because you had Llorente, a centre-back, in a position that he shouldn't have been, making a really difficult pass that he shouldn't have made. And then Stoic, who hardly ever scores goals, heading it in. But in the middle of that, you've got exactly the sort of guy who you want in those circumstances, teeing the cross up.
You're going to be all right this week?
I would have thought so. I said to my editors this morning, I don't really know what to write. It's kind of like last week on repeat. I mean, there'll be a hell of a lot of finger crossing going on, because I don't think anybody will expect Leeds to take a great deal from Brentford. It's a winnable game, without a doubt, but Brentford have a lot about them and have always had a lot about them that can trouble Leeds and bother Leeds with their style. And in between that, you have Burnley away at Aston Villa, and then Burnley at home to Newcastle on Sunday, which they could conceivably get something from. It doesn't feel like this is done, put it that way.
I don't know why I'm doing this, because you're not playing, but good luck.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we've needed it.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, a draw at the weekend means a top half finish for Aston Villa is unlikely, but the big news to come out of the club has been the signing of Philippe Coutinho on a permanent deal. Greg Evans covers Villa for The Athletic and joins us now. How much was this in the end?
So it was 20 million euros, around about 17 million pounds, which was a slight reduction.
That's unbelievable, yeah. Isn't it? How on earth have they managed that?
Yeah, very good question. I think, well, Barcelona first and foremost wanted to get the money into their accounts for this accounting year. So they wanted to get the deal done before June 30th. Villa had agreed an initial £33 million transfer fee with Barcelona when Coutinho came on loan in January, but they were able to get it down to just 17 million, which for me, I think is incredible business.
That's a 50% discount.
Indeed.
It's a 50% discount on a player that they've had for 6 months.
Indeed,
as well.
Yeah. I mean, it just shows really, doesn't it, how desperate Barcelona were to get him off the books. We were well aware of Barcelona's desperation to move him on and get his wage bill off the books when he moved in January. But yeah, it just shows, doesn't it? Incredible, really, to think that he was a £108 million player just a few years ago.
Is that Christian Perslow then?
Yeah, Christian Perslow is the main negotiator at Aston Villa. He will have driven a very hard bargain and would have been able to get this deal done. But yeah, I think a lot of credit does go to Villa for managing to get this deal over the line. But I think also the desperation from Barcelona to move him on should also be factored in.
And presumably, now they've got that down, that gives them more wriggle room this summer, doesn't it? I mean, they've invested heavily in this squad over recent transfer windows. And would you expect them to go again this summer?
Yeah, I think so. I wrote a piece this morning just saying how they have been quite calculated, really, with some of their transfers in recent times. There was a need to get a defensive midfielder in probably the last two windows, but Villa decided that because the deals weren't right for them at the time, they were prepared to wait for a little bit longer. So Calvin Phillips was a player that Villa had been long interested in, failed to get him, I think, in 2018, 2019. If Leeds do go down, you know, as we've just heard on the podcast, then Villa will be in for him again. Whether they can get that deal over the line remains to be seen. And obviously Leeds' situation all depends on that anyway. But there are a handful of players that Villa have looked at in defensive midfield. Yves Bissouma of Brighton was a player they bid for in January. But again, they weren't prepared to pay over the odds for him because he was coming into his final year of his deal from this summer. So that would make potentially a deal cheaper this summer. And also Boubacar Kamara of Marseille, a player again coming towards the end of his contract over in France, and somebody who will be probably the best freebie on the market this summer.
Is that because they think they might lose Douglas Luiz? Is that because they're not happy? Is that to rotate a bit more? I mean, it's interesting, isn't it, actually? Because the balance of the Villa midfield going forward will be fascinating if you throw Coutinho in there as well and John McGinn to Buendia, depending on where Buendia's going to be used and the formations. There are actually quite a few questions around Villa's midfield and formation.
There are, yeah. And I mean, you know, there's Morgan Sanson also in there and Jacob Ramsey, who's developed this year. So, and Kani Chukwuemeka, you know, a young player who Villa have high hopes for. So there's six players there in midfield already. Marvellous Nakamba, who played at the weekend, has come back from injury. Villa will have to move on some of these players. You know, there's no way they can continue stockpiling players in this area and not using them. They need to find some value in them and move them on. And that will hopefully free up funds to get a proper defensive midfielder in. What I would say is that other than Nakamba, who has his shortcomings, you know, we've seen over three seasons now, he's a very hit and miss player. He does the defensive side of things quite well, but he struggles a little bit technically and moving the ball out of defensive midfield. Villa haven't really ever had a solid defensive midfielder that can do a bit of everything. Douglas Luiz, as you first mentioned there, for me, looks better in a more advanced midfield role in sort of a number eight and struggles a little bit defensively. So I just think Villa need to really get that tried and trusted performer in there. You know, a plug-in and play player, somebody who would just come in and make that team better. And that's what they're looking to do.
Given sort of Gerrard's success in attracting Coutinho, and obviously there's a playing relationship there, are Villa in any way changing some of their targets because they now believe they have a manager who can attract I'm not trying to be detrimental to past managers or past players, but do they feel they have more of a figurehead to attract the best?
100%. And let's get it right. If it wasn't for Gerrard, there's no way this Philippe Coutinho deal would have happened. And what I forgot to mention also was that Villa did include a 50% sell-on clause with Barcelona for Coutinho. So he signed a four-year deal. If he does move on in those 4 years, Barcelona will get 50% of whatever Villa move him on for. And look, Steven Gerrard said this week that he still believes Coutinho's in his prime. So, you know, there might be still a couple of good years left in him and potentially a bit of money going back to Barcelona in that direction. But yeah, look, Villa know that Steven Gerrard can attract better players. It's one of the reasons why he was given the job. And the Coutinho deal proves that.
Expectations will change, won't they, for next season? I mean, we looked at the teams who are between 8th and 13th on Sunday's Match of the Day 2. They all played yesterday. And I asked the pundits, you know, who's going to push on next season out of, you know, from Wolves in 8th, and it includes Brentford and Brighton and Leicester and Palace. And Villa are in 13th. Villa are the last of all those clubs. And they both went Villa. They both expect Villa to push on. So expectations in externally and internally, I'm guessing, will be very different next season.
Yeah, I think next season is the one that Villa really need to get much closer, or if not into the top seven. You know, the hope is to get European football as soon as possible. the not expectation, but the hope again internally was that Villa would have got a little bit closer this season. And I think if you speak to supporters and they look at the 13th place position, just say, for example, Dean Smith was still in charge and you ask Aston Villa supporters, would you change this summer to try and get a manager in who will help the club get closer into that top half? And I think a lot of them would have said, yeah, let's give it a change. But it's not that easy, and it just shows how hard it is to break the gap. Villa have got a lot of catching up to do. You know, it was only 3 years ago they were in the Championship, and I think what they've been able to do in those 3 years and try and bridge the gap and become an established Premier League team again is quite admirable. But there's still a little bit of work to do, and the expectation next season will definitely be to be in the top half at least, and then pushing closer to the top seven.
Cheers, Greg. Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Well, let's end the pod by talking about Watford, the Athletic's Adam Leventhal covers the club, relegated from the Premier League, of course, thrashed at the weekend. But maybe a glimmer of light with the appointment of Rob Edwards as their new manager for next season. Although on the evidence of yesterday, on the evidence of the last few months, he's got a right job on his hands, hasn't he?
Yeah, just a bit. It's it was a bit of a circus at Vicarage Road against Leicester City, and the Watford hierarchy have got a lot of things wrong this season, and I've written about it, you know, pretty extensively over the last 3 years, to be honest, on The Athletic, but in particular this season. But at least they've made one good decision, which is to keep him out of it and not bring him in to adopt this awful performing side at the moment. And he, yeah, watched on from the crowd and will be under no illusions as to the job that he's got to take on next season.
Before we come on to him, I sort of, just on this current Watford, and I think it's really interesting when you work across all sorts of different media, you work with people and there's a Watford game on, and it might be on the TV or it might be on the radio or whatever. I've never known one side's team sheet have to be referenced so much by pundits over the course of the season. And that's by people who know football, but they go, hang on a minute, who's that? Who's that? And I wonder whether that is Watford's problem in a very basic nutshell at the moment.
I think there's a certain degree of that, but maybe that is because a lot of people that are outside of the Watford bubble just find it very difficult to keep track of the club as a whole in general. Mm. So there's not really any identifying factors that you think, oh, well, that is Watford. You know, I understand, you know, he's the captain. There is no longer any, you know, Troy Deeney, which was quite handy for people. He was the go-to guy because he was, you know, very much a talismanic figure. I do get that. And I think that especially, you know, the game against Leicester yesterday and the game against Everton, you know, post-relegation being confirmed has really been the second string. And there's been a whole sort of raft of players, some that have been injured, some that might not be that injured, and quite a few that are being wrapped in cotton wool because they're ready for the fire sale or they're being released on freeze because they've got release clauses and things like that. So, you know, the last two games have been very difficult to identify with. The quality of the performances and the fact that so many players prior to that have been sort of notable players, perhaps, you know, the likes of Moussa Sissoko or Joshua King or Ismail Assar or Manuel Dennis. You know, they're players that people know, players that people might have picked in their fantasy teams and things like that, but they just genuinely haven't clicked. They haven't been able to put a run of form together. And I think it goes higher than just simply being the players. I think it goes right to the top. I think, you know, the running of the club is just suspect at the moment, and they need to change. They need to try and change that culture.
Will they want to clear the decks for Edwards, part one? And part two, will they be able to clear the decks for Edwards?
Well, I think there are some players that will definitely leave, so that will help. That will be a catalyst for change. Ismail Assar Emmanuel Dennis, Moussa Sissoko, Joshua King, Danny Rose, Ben Foster. They are all leaving if the right people come along, obviously. And obviously that is, you know, the second part of your question, that someone needs to be able to come along. And
they won't get anywhere near the money for Sarr, for example, will they, that they would have done a year ago?
No. But I think that with that signing or that potential sale, I think that having seen him underperform so much this season, I think people will work out that this has been a particularly disrupted season out of his control, really. You know, obviously he picked up an injury, which was a significant knee ligament injury, then had to go to Africa Cup of Nations and, you know, had a successful time with Senegal. Then he came back meeting, another new manager. I think people might actually go, look, if we take him under our wing, I think there is a player there. And yes, they might get a cut price deal, but also they will be dealing with Gino Pozzo, who is shrewd, ruthless, whatever you want to call him, in terms of player trading and things like that. So he will drive a hard bargain, but they do know that they have to sell. And yes, there will probably be a cut price deal there. But Gino Pozzo, as we've said, you know, he's not gonna lie down and have his tummy tickled in this sort of negotiation. So they will want to drive the price up.
The appointment of Rob Edwards appears to have given the Watford fan base quite a lot of hope, judging by the Watford fans that I have spoken to or read comments from online. Before we look to the future, how did they go about getting him? And was it as devious as Forest Green Rovers are suggesting?
Well, it's an interesting one. And I can understand Dale Vince, the Forest Green Rovers owner's frustration, because I think he feels like, look, we've had a really good season and maybe I deserved a bit more honesty. But there are always two sides to the story, and you're not going to jump ship if there isn't a ship there already docked and ready to sort of deliver you off to somewhere else. So I can understand both sides of it. He's frustrated. Rob Edwards was, you know, wanting to feather his nest and make sure that, you know, he's sorted. So when push came to shove, that was the time to have the conversation. In terms of them wanting him, they'd obviously, you know, had the experience of two elder statesmen in Claudio Ranieri and Roy Hodgson. They knew that it was going south. They knew that the connection wasn't quite there with the players, really. And they wanted to try and change direction. They've done it before. They've got this sort of pendulum swinging way of appointing head coaches, from a grumpy one to a happy one, from an inexperienced one to an old one. They do it all the time. But hopefully this might actually change something, you know, actually putting some faith. I say this all qualified, obviously, putting some faith in a younger manager who has had some success. And he has had success as well, building his coaching resume in the Championship with Wolves, where he also played the majority of his career as well. He's also, you know, been on the staff with England and things like that. So it is a gamble, obviously, but they have paid a little bit of money, which is a rarity for Watford. And yes, it is it's a window into the future. Just seeing someone new, fresh-faced on the pitch at Vicarage Road against Leicester was just a little crumb of comfort after a horrendous season. So that they're hopeful, but, you know, there is hope and expectation on him as well, which is going to be tough for him to deal with.
Is he going into the same structure that the old one, the grumpy one, the happy one, the experienced one have all tried to work under? Or is it going into a structure that will be refreshed to maximise his talents? So if you look at other coaches that have been plucked from the England setup to then forge a managerial path, they've then gone into a structure that has... Steve Cooper's a prime example, yeah. Both at Swansea and at Nottingham Forest. Gone into a structure where he's then been able to exploit his contacts to bring young domestic players in. Is Rob Edwards going to be afforded that same opportunity?
If a leopard will change its spots, then yes. But we know that that doesn't often happen. And I think that it will need a huge amount of introspection from someone who is not famed for that, i.e. Gino Pozzo, someone who's very stubborn. Some people might call him arrogant, being quite detached, even though he's very, very hands-on. I think it needs a change in approach. He needs to listen and accept that this way of doing things is not working. And he's got a very, very strong body of work over the last three seasons from that initial relegation to now bouncing back up, but in a very strange season with COVID. And then this season, which is Watford's worst season in the top flight, going all the way back. You know, they haven't spent much time in the top flight, but this is their worst season. So there needs to be some sort of change. Otherwise, it will literally just be like chucking a tree into a shredder. Again, look, there goes another one. There goes another one. It has to change. If it doesn't change, ultimately, it will only be Gino Pozzo that suffers. And his asset will continue to diminish in value. And he has to accept that the structure has to change. It's not going to happen overnight. But I think the one thing that Rob Edwards can do is come in with a fresh outlook in the way that he approaches things, in the way that he can get his players on board. And he will just hope for less interference from above. And if he gets the results, that naturally happens. The interference comes when Gino starts to get a little bit worried and a little bit tetchy about things. And, you know, he gets tetchy quicker than most people.
But that's the problem, isn't it, Adam? Because this is a big job. This is a big job with a fractured squad, with a lot of people going. It's a club that needs a reset and a rebuild. And, you know, if Watford are seventh come the start of October, that's not necessarily a bad start for Rob Edwards, given the starting position. But the owner might very well think they ought to be top two.
Yeah, I agree. That may well happen, and that will most probably be the view from the top. But this time around, if there is another sort of early fracture in the relationship, if there is signs of progression, if there is a change, if there is better football, if there is some blooding of youngsters going on in the side at that time, the fans' ire is not really on the dugout anymore. It's sometimes on the players that may be disenfranchised, disillusioned, but it is all focused on the top now. And that is where, you know, if you are saying publicly, not him personally, but Chief Executive Chairman Scott Duxbury saying things publicly, now it's accountability time. If you don't then deliver, then the fans will rise up ultimately. And, you know, hopefully it doesn't get to that point. And hopefully Watford will have enough quality to be competitive right up at the top of the Championship. But yeah, it's a hell of a lot of work that Rob Edwards has got to do. But I think that he's going to have the fans backing, even if it is going to take a little bit of time. Just one interesting thing. It's interesting that Brendan Rodgers, he actually got his first start in management at Watford. And I actually spoke to him in an interview way back, and he said, I tried to change the style of football. And I remember a passage of play. We were playing against Doncaster. There was four passes, and the fans, after AD Boothroyd, were getting a bit worried. They were thinking, oh, why are they passing the ball so much? We're going to be back there again. He's going to try and change the style of football. And the Watford fans, hopefully, this time around, they won't get worried and they will keep faith. But also, they will also have one eye on Gino Pozzo up in that director's box and saying, look, come on. Come on, you need to change too.
That's it. If you want to read more on all of the stories we've discussed today on The Athletic, you can subscribe now for just £1 a month. Head to theathletic.com/footballpod. And I'm back on Thursday on this feed with Matt Slater for the Business of Sport pod. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.